said in the meeting, with three or four young, bright people in, from his administration. And I learned he used to do this deliberately to give the younger members of his administration as much exposure to outside and different points of view as possible. One of the topics of discussion was the aircraft carrier base that the Navy was looking for. Possibility of Singapore. The Prime Minister did not say yes, but he made it clear, I'm not saying no. Suggested Trincomalee in Sri Lanka would be much better. And don't take it for granted that Sri Lanka would say no. And certainly is much much more strategically placed for the purposes of the Indian Ocean. But what I remember most was as we walked in, Lee Kuan Yew was receiving us. He said, ah, to me, so you're the American ambassador in Peking. Tell me, who is the more trustworthy, Deng Xiaoping or Hua Guofeng? I was taken aback, but I'm afraid I gave an undiplomatic answer. I said, Deng Xiaoping. Mm-hmm. He says, I agree with you. found him much, much better to talk to, much more forthright. And I would trust him, he said. The other man, no. And then we went to and spent a week at Baguio in the Philippines, at the where the embassy has that other lovely residence up in the mountains. This had been arranged with Ambassador Dick Murphy and Ann Murphy, his wife, some time before. And so it was purely coincidental that on our first, second day there, a Sunday, Dick Holbrook arrived with the Admiral, and they had come to Baguio to meet with Marcos, who was in Baguio at the time, and would they have been talking then about the bases?
Could be.
Possibly.
There were some base problems too, as I recall.
Right. And then they left, they had the meeting on the on the morning and the next day, Monday, and left that afternoon, met with Marcos all morning. So that we spent that whole week in Baguio, and it was a very lovely time. Stayed the one night with the Murphys at the residence in Manila, and got to know them quite well. We had not met them until the meeting in Singapore, and of course he is now back with his first interest, the Middle East.
Right. Do you recall now what your own thoughts were concerning your ambassadorship, you knew that a Carter visit was not going to take place. You knew that much of the relationship which you had come out to establish had been established. There was the military relationship to be worked out, but more on Washington's side now, with the Gung Biao visit soon to be scheduled and that kind of thing. Did you feel that you were now just beginning to mark time?
No. The feeling I had at this point was there's still a great deal of work to be done. We did not have a maritime agreement. We were making very halting passes at an air transport agreement. The consular agreement was limping along. Although the trade agreement was in place, there was still, had a feeling of urgency. There were so many things to be done, and to be done as quickly as possible. In my mind in particular, to try to get them out of the way within the calendar year of 1980.
So you still had a good agenda going at this point?
Oh, yes, definitely.
And had you set this forth with the Chinese so that they knew what the agenda was, and that there was, in some sense, a deadline in your mind before the electoral season descended?
Not at this point. I did when the discussions I had with Han Xu in May, in this country, in May of 1980, because I hadn't been back very long, where I quickly got the feeling that at the very best, the November election was up for grabs. And the longer I stayed, the more I developed the feeling that it was weighted very much against mm-hmm. President Carter. Mm-hmm. And so I had my first conversations with Han Xu that they should begin to think about these problems, and that we should get as many of the issues that we're working on out of the way as quickly as in good conscience we could. But that didn't immediately happen. That we can attach to the record without putting them on here.
Oh, excellent.
For example, prior to Vice President Mondale's visit, I'd refer to this, but I was asked would I consider becoming the trade representative. And my reply to that was I didn't say no, obviously. But I put a heavy emphasis on the continuing need of my presence as ambassador in Peking because of all of the unfinished business, and that continued well into 1980. And other documents that are pertinent, but which we don't need to take up this time for. So at this point we were at the into March of 1980, and still a lot of businessmen coming. TWA, for example, tried very hard to sell CAAC on a management contract whereby they would bring the international service of CAAC up to world-class levels.
They have a similar arrangement with the Saudis, as I recall.
The TWA
had hoped to, in fact, get the first route to to China. They bid for it. Obviously, Pan Am got it. And TWA, cognizant of Northwest being a strong claimant on the second route, wished to get their foot in the door. Their marketing strategy, therefore, was to establish a relationship with CAAC that would be so strong that within 2 years, when a second American carrier would have the opportunity to enter China, TWA would be designated.
Yes, the others, Pan Am in particular, were quite upset that what they considered the unnecessary concessions that TWA was dangling in front of the Chinese in that venture.
It did not come to fruition.
It did not come to fruition, no. Then at this point, Boeing delivered the first of the 747s, and we had quite a turnover ceremony in connection with that on the 10th of March. T. Wilson, the chairman of the board and chief executive officer, and a high-powered delegation was over. Governor Thornburgh came with a Pennsylvania delegation, and in connection with that, U.S. Steel was getting on the short end of a contract bid, I think in connection with some piece of Baoshan, maybe not.
Either that or Anshan. I do not remember.
Governor and I made an emergency visit with Tang Ke, who was then Minister of Metallurgy, the negotiations had gone on, and the Chinese had just notified U.S. Steel that there was no point to them coming for further negotiations, and that the matter was effectively closed in the sense that they were no longer in the running. And they had appealed to the governor and myself, to try and get them the right to continue the negotiations, which the minister agreed to, but making it very clear that there wouldn't be much hope, but they could, if they wished, have another meeting.
Had you met Tang Ke before?
Yes. I'd met him once before. Not on a one-on-one meeting. This was just with himself and a couple of the high officials of the ministry.
What kind of person was he? He has, as you know, just become Minister of Petroleum. He suffered a political reversal after you met him in connection with the Baoshan Steel.
Right.
It was thought that his career had perhaps been seriously damaged. Lo and behold, in the reorganization of early 1982, he shows up as Minister of Petroleum.
Well, in this meeting, of course, we were the petitioner, and the governor did most of the talking on behalf of U.S. Steel. Tonka knew, of course, what we were coming for, so he was well briefed, but he handled himself in a businesslike fashion, knew what the whole project was about, and knew all the details, and gave every evidence of being a competent official, and was really quite straightforward in the meeting about practically saying, well, since you gentlemen are asking for it, we'll agree to another meeting, but American style, don't get your hopes up, which we duly conveyed to U.S. Steel. And the delegation came from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and were guests of the Academy of Chinese Academy of Sciences, and were extremely well treated. Then a hydropower delegation came at this point that was a product of the vice president's visit, headed by the head of TVA. Had several meetings with the Chinese. Of course, the Chinese were extremely interested. I must say that when the TVA man told them that he could justify the spending of money at interest rates of 18% and 20% with the profit potential that it could bring, I thought that the Chinese would have apoplexy on the spot, because anything even approaching 10%, they considered most horrendous. And the hydropower delegation, the highest official they met was Vice Premier Yu Jiuli. I see that on March 21st, and this is of some importance, I had my first meeting with the representatives of the United Nations Development Program and IBM on the problem of the export license for the computers to be used in connection with the census, which at that time was they hoped would be held in 1981. It was subsequently, of course, pushed down to 1982, being held currently. And we talked about the procedures to be followed, and they harked back, of course, to the new policies stated by Secretary Brown, confirmed by the Vice President. But that was March 21st, 1980. It was, I think, October of 1981 before that export license was finally granted. And I noted that a few weeks ago, Deng Xiaoping referred to this, the slowness of it, as being part of his dissatisfaction with the American connection.
Where did you see that reference?
I think it was in the Asian Wall Street Journal. It wouldn't have been in the Phibus reports, because I'm way, way behind on those.
Yeah. I had not noticed that.
But it was just a passing reference to it in a meeting. Would it have been Vice President Bush? Anyway, one of the meetings within the recent past. But we spent a lot of time on that, and were assured of clearances at high levels, but then when it got down to the bowels of the bureaucracy at home, it's almost as though it disappeared.
That is a horrendous problem in the U.S. government, and in 1980 it was compounded by the bureaucrats' sense that Jimmy Carter would have a limited tenure in office.
Then I note that I went to a reception at the Great Hall for President Mobutu of Zaire, who paid a chief of state visit to China. And the provincial delegations are still going. This one from Hubei province, where they were going to be guests of the Governor Rhodes of Ohio. And I note that on March 29th, the Stag Dinner, for the Massachusetts Trade Delegation, headed by the Lieutenant Governor O'Neill, son of Tip O'Neill. Our host was Wong Yao Ting, the famous Mao Tai drinker. And Tom O'Neill was contesting with him for a while, but retired from the fray. And then he surreptitiously filled his glass with water and offered a toast again to Mr. Wong. And in his response, Mr. Wong stood up, which was somewhat strange, and acknowledged the toast, and then said, "An old Chinese custom, we now trade glasses." How he had seen him put the water in his glass, I don't know. He gave absolutely no evidence of it until he said, "We now trade glasses." And a reception for the Gil Robinson and the group handling the PRC exhibit. Again, Wong Yao Ting was the chief Chinese personage. And their lack of experience, the Americans' lack of experience, was showing up all over the place.
We discussed this before. This was the Robinson Arnie de Kaiser.
Right. And had a meeting with Vice Premier Boy Bo, who apparently was given the general top level supervision of this effort by the Chinese, and of course who in fact came to open the exhibition in San Francisco. Maritime negotiations are going on at this point. We talked about this yesterday on Easter Sunday, April the 6th. We had an 11 o'clock egg hunt at the residence for the children. And
where did you hide the eggs?
Outside.
Oh, that must have been lots of fun.
Yeah. The eggs were hidden by the older children so that they had the fun of hiding them. And then they were to be discovered by the younger children. And then we followed that by an Easter lunch for everybody. And we had outdoor barbecues where we grilled hamburgers and hot dogs and had soda pop and so on. Our barbecues were half an oil drum turned over. And the question came, these were very big in diameter, where do we get the grills? But Mr. Wong, our butler, had a friend who worked in a metalworking factory, so we had the grills made to order in this factory. They were circular, so that they sat right on top. It was a most very efficient barbecue indeed.
And then, do you use charcoal or wood?
We use charcoal.
Oh, but of course that's easily available.
Right. Yes, we use charcoal. Then a delegation of librarians came this time, headed by the chief librarian at the Congressional Library. What's it called?
Library of Congress.
Library of Congress.
Daniel Borstein.
Right. And they had a very they brought in librarians from all over China to meet with them. And it was really quite impressive. The Chinese were most interested. And of course, their libraries had really been badly used in the Cultural Revolution, and most of them were in pretty bad shape. I had a session with the British ambassador following the visit to China of Defense Minister Pim, in which the ambassador told me that the Chinese had indicated, yes, they were interested in buying British arms. They'd like two of this airplane and a couple of the anti-tank device and one or two tanks, possibly. Minister had explained to them that these were private companies, and it was most unlikely that they would sell one or two items that could then be copied or attempted to be copied. You know, those in this country who talk about selling weapons systems to the Chinese, they've had opportunities. Britain, Italy, France, I think, backed off because of Soviet pressures. But they have had opportunities that they haven't taken any advantage of.
Well, the French, you're right about the French. Although the French backed off for another reason, the French had sought to link arms sales to a more substantive economic relationship. You will remember on Guiscard's visit in 1979, he had grandiose plans for a nuclear reactor sale, I believe a couple other clearly civilian-type sales. And then all of this, the development of a security relationship, military sales, and the civilian economic relationship was to be financed by this substantial French credit that the government of France was prepared to extend to China. And the Chinese just didn't want to buy big in that area. And I think the French then became disappointed as a result.
I see.
I think your point, though, is very, very well taken. Chinese have had several opportunities to buy military hardware and have not pursued it. I am not certain, by the way, that a sale of two or three items would do very much for the Chinese anyway, because the Chinese ability to copy is very limited. Their capacity for reverse engineering is slow.
I think they know that now. I'm not sure they understood it that well in early 1980.
I think by 80 they did. I think maybe 2 years previously when they began to look at the Harrier, that may have been a problem. But I think within that intervening period, they had begun to acquire a sense of the difficulties. And so I think that what they may have been interested in is two tanks plus the technology that goes with it. That the British would not do.
Right. Then another congressional delegation headed by Jonathan Bingham, which was just a routine congressional visit.
Do you remember the committee that represented?
No, I don't. But there was an item in the Congress that was of some importance at the time, to which had to do with the Trade Act. By this time, most favored nation status was out of the way, wasn't it?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Yeah.
Textiles? No.
No, it wasn't textiles.
Renewal of the Trade Act? There's the annual renewal. There's always a question with the Chinese as to whether the Jackson-Vanik waiver is to be extended.
Could
that
have been
has
that.
To be re-extended on an annual basis.
Could have been that. But anyway, there was some item in which the congressman had a key position because I had been alerted to discuss it with him.
My impression on Bingham, and it's superficial, could be wrong, is that he was very supportive of normalization, but that by this period in 1980, he was beginning to have some qualms about the China relationship, at least qualms about its extending into the security realm. As I recall, even at the time of extension of MFN, and you're correct, he was involved in that, because at the time of extension to MFN, he was inclined to hold off on MFN until we could grant it to the Soviets. And as I recall, he was somewhat sympathetic to, shall we say, the Marshall Shulman view of how we should be handling the relationship. Does that ring at all the bell?
Yes, that, I think that was it. It turned out okay.
Yes.
But he was very questioning.
What,
not in any hostile way, but a thoughtful way.
I agree with that. No, and the issue for him, he was satisfied at the time of extension of MFN to China by administration assurances that after passage of SALT, it was our intent to take a close look at MFN for the Soviet Union.
Right. But the delegation was well hosted by the Chinese. They too had been aware of the importance of this delegation and Congressman Bingham in particular. Then I note we had a reception at the residence for Liu Huaqing and the military delegation. And that was the first time that any substantial number of high-ranking military figures had come to the residence, as I remember it. And they were... The atmosphere was much more relaxed than for many of the Chinese delegations. Well, they were all getting pretty much relaxed by that time. But... See, when Secretary Brown was there, I don't think we had no reception at the residence.
No.
No. In fact, at that point, I think we'd made, through our military attaché, discreet inquiries as to the possibility. But the fact that this delegation was the military delegation going to the U.S. and the success of the Brown visit from many points of view led them to come. And, of course, they spent, it was about 5 weeks in the U.S. prior to the Gung Biao visit in May.
For the record, Liu Huaqing was Deputy Chief of Staff.
Right.
You may have said that.
No, I didn't. And the CODEL was received by Vice Premier Gu Mu. And then a delegation from Henan Province, the reception for them going to the U.S., so there were a lot of them at this point. Also at this time, there were Ford and RCA, Ford Aerospace, RCA, Hughes Aircraft, and two others all had delegations in China, and the vain attempt to try to land the communications satellite contract, which, of course, was finally postponed.
Were you there when it was postponed?
I don't think the official action had been taken, but it was pretty generally understood that it was, because there were long, long gaps. And
did it fall victim to retrenchment in
yes.
that December 1980?
I think so, yes.
That's too bad. You know, we should go back to them. That's a 1982 discussion, really, talking about current policy. We should go back to them and try to revive that. I think it's one of those kind of highly visible, symbolic acts between two countries that have widespread long-term ramifications. I was very sorry to see that one show.
And could be of great utility
That's
to the
right.
Chinese.
I agree with that.
One of the many visits of Arkansas Congressman Bill Alexander, who's a deputy whip, I guess, in the House, within a year, I think, made three or four trips to China.
Very active, a very attractive person, I found. Very
yes, he is.
Very assertive and very interested in the China relationship. His interest is partly economic for his district. His
right.
district exports cotton to China and soybeans.
Soybeans, right.
But he also has an intellectual interest in
yes.
China.
He's very bright politically, too.
Right,
right. Great political knowledge.
Hard to see how he's going to break through in Arkansas with their senatorial lineup, and he might one day.
And then John Roderick hosted a dinner at his residence on April 12th, looking to his coming retirement and leaving China.
Now, who would he have invited for his banquet, do you remember?
Well, this was just a small dinner in his apartment.
Who else?
Vicky Graham, his associate, was there. And a couple of American businessmen. I don't think there were other journalists there. There may have been a couple. May have been a couple of them. There were about 10 or 12 of us.
He also had a good cook.
Yes.
As I recall.
And the civil air negotiations were getting to a critical point in this period.
Do you recall the key issues there?
Our insistence on more than one carrier, the more than one carrier not being economically feasible, but the principle of the right to have more than one carrier. And of course, this was something new to the Chinese. All their other experiences had been with national airlines, so this problem did not arise. Complicated, too, by the ongoing arguments with the Japanese about landing rights in Tokyo. And there were Those were the critical elements.
Frequency.
Frequency, yes.
And then cost sharing. Wasn't there an issue and I think it
there was an
resolved
issue of cost
in CAC and to CAC's favor. CAC feared the competition with Pan Am that Pan Am would have all the international fares and CAC would be
cost sharing was a problem, but the reason I didn't say it was critical. At this point, we weren't saying so, but we knew this was something on which we would we'd have to be generous is not the right word. We'd have to be sensible on the sharing, because otherwise Chinese were right. Until they upgraded their service, it would have been entirely lopsided. And I think, too, we had some obligation. The Chinese had committed, what, $50 million or more for the three 747s they had bought. They tried to back out of the purchase of the third one. And the 10 707s they have and the three 747s, during my time in China, were never properly utilized. You could go out that airport, you'd see at least one 747, frequently two, just sitting there. Their utilization way below world standards, and that, of course, was also true of the 10 707s.
I think a distinction should be made between the 707 and 747s. However, 707s remain underutilized. 747s are used less than by international standards. However, the load factor of the 747s is sufficient now that the Chinese want more.
I see. Well, of course, there's been a big change from the...
But that was understood when they bought the three, because they were really just beginning their international service.
Right.
I do not think that that has been a bad decision for them. 707s clearly was a bad decision.
Well, it's the... The more they get involved in the international market, the more they learn and can apply those lessons
right.
to the more efficient utilization of their domestic market, so that there'll be a spillover benefit there.
But the main point, I think, make explicit here is that in all of the negotiations, be they the civil aviation agreement or the consular agreement we talked about yesterday, the two sides approach the discussions with particular interest to protect and a particular interest to advance. And over a period of time, agreements were made in which both sides yielded. I don't think it's fair to say in the series of negotiations in which you were involved that an overall pattern of one side caving into the others was how resolutions were made.
No. In the consular agreement, for example, the Chinese moved a long way from not only what had been their original position, but from what they had done with other nations in consular agreements. And we were quite satisfied with the product of the consular agreement and the civil air agreement. Was a fair agreement. It was not a concessionary agreement by any means. Recognized realities and
with the two-carrier principle?
With the multiple-carrier principle.
Was it multiple or two?
I think my memory says it was multiple, but only two determined.
That's right. You're right.
And it takes consent, of course, so that it can't. It's not a unilateral decision of the U.S.,
But basically, the Chinese were committed through that agreement to add a second carrier in the third year of the...
Right, Northwest.
No designation.
I thought Northwest was designated.
No designation.
Well, I guess the decision for Pan Am was three votes and two votes for Northwest.
That's right.
And I guess, yeah. My assumption was, well, Northwest will be next, I see.
If there's no... that... is something that will be fought out. My guess is that United will try hard.
United now has rights in Tokyo.
That's exactly
just
right.
Just obtained, so that changes the picture.
And my guess is also the TWA will try again, though I don't think... They have a historic claim And Pan Am used their historic claim in their arguments, and the TWA claim would be via Europe.
Of course, Northwest has a historic claim, too.
That's right. That's right. I personally think Northwest.
United is the only one that does not have
That's
a historic
right.
claim.
That's right.